Extinctions are a natural process with climate change, but it's grim. The UN, the United Nations, says as many as 1 million animals and plant species are threatened with going extinct across the globe, many within decades, more than ever before in human history. But what if we could change that through cloning? Let's discuss on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Do you think that we should be preserving DNA from endangered animals? What animals are you worried might go extinct? What should humans do to save them? It's 800-642-1234. Francisco Pellegri is a professor of genetics and medical genetics at UW-Madison. For years, he's been furthering the idea of banks for animal DNA as a way of saving endangered species. Francisco, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, give us a tour of a biobank, a genetic bank for animals. What is it?
Well, the biobanks have, they're not a new idea. They started, there's already a longstanding biobank in the San Diego Zoo that started in 1972, I believe. And they store samples. They can be samples of what's called somatic tissue. So it could be any part of your body, like a muscle or skin cells. And they also store gametes, which would be sperm and eggs. And sometimes they store frozen embryos. And so, for example, the San Diego Zoo has about 10,000 samples. There's also a conglomerate that is based in London that is called the Frozen Ark, that is also a longstanding that started in 2004. The Audubon Center also has, there's an Audubon Center for Endangered Species from that is at the University of New Orleans. They also have samples. So they basically store samples and then hope that those samples can be used later to recreate an animal with various methods that are molecular and involve reprogramming and reproductive biology.
Yeah, you mentioned San Diego Zoo's Frozen Zoo, as they call it, or its global biobank, and containing over 10,000 living cell cultures. What is the impact of that kind of banking on humankind and knowing the complex animal life and how it evolved?
What do you mean by that question?
Well, I'm wondering what is the impact of that when you store over 10,000 living cell cultures?
Well, there's a commitment impact that you're committing yourself to store all these samples. And so it's a long-term project. Recently, for example, there's the cloning of a black-footed ferret that was a collaboration of the San Diego Zoo with an organization, nonprofit called Revive and Restore. And they cloned a black-footed ferret, which is an endangered species, a highly endangered species in the United States. And they used a sample that had been stored for 40 years. And so this was a cell, literally a nucleus, that they had a couple of individuals had been stored. And by cloning this animal, what they used is an egg of a captive black-footed ferret. And they used the nucleus that had been frozen for 40 years. And that allowed them to get a black-footed ferret that is now alive. It's called Elizabeth Ann and was born last year. And this black-footed ferret has three times more genetic diversity than the entire population that is alive now. And we know that genetic diversity is key for the success of a population. And so what that means is that long-term investment is now paying off. It's paying off in the terms. And now we can help a species survive much better because they have a lot more genetic diversity than what they have come down to through human action, which is the loss of the population over time.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Francisco Pellegri, who is a professor of genetics and medical genetics at the UW, discussing the idea of an animal vault and what it would mean for interspecies cloning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we should be preserving DNA from endangered animals? What animals are you most concerned about and how should we go about saving them? Call in. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring in Lou now in Ashland County. Hi, Lou. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. The question was that you brought up at the start of the program that what can we do? We can leave animals alone. We can you know, get our stuff together. And I'm cleaning it up a bit. This is really kind of ticking me off. We got to stop playing creator, and we need to be there for the earth and all its inhabitants and, you know, stop mucking it up. Because we saw when the pandemic started and we kept to ourselves and in our houses, the world healed. Things got cleaner, the water, the air, animals came out. We, as humans, are the number one problem, and we need to get our act together.
Lou, thank you for that. Francisco, you know, Lou bringing up, you know, habitat destruction and things like that. We should really be focusing on climate change and what we are doing to change, you know, in changing the climate before we decide to clone animals.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Lou, actually. I agree entirely that we have to clean up the house and take care of the environment. And obviously, a wolf would not be useful at all without the environment and the habitat that it's there to help. What we're suggesting is the use of all the tools we have available to help manage the populations that are now there. There's a lot of, even when we try to clean up the house, there's a lot of uncertainty happening right now. There's a lot of stressors that are going to continue happening in the next century. If you look at, for example, the wildfires in Australia, they killed one, an estimated they have either killed or displaced 1 to 3 billion animals. And those are animals that once that happens, the population is decimated. You know, it can be decimated. That means that the genetic diversity can be really reduced. And for a population, the genetic diversity is essentially its immune system. You have genetic diversity, but you have different alleles, there are different gene variants that allow you to survive various stressors, including pathogens and other kinds of changes in the ecosystem. Without that genetic diversity, you have the population has no immune system. The Tasmanian devil, for example, is a great example. It's so low in genetic diversity that the population is being decimated by a cancer that is affecting all of them. Normally,
say that again. Which,
the Tasmanian devil?
Carry on.
Being estimated by a transmissible cancer, and the reason is because they're so homogeneous genetically. So what we're suggesting is to have a bank in the same way that you have a plant bank. You know, just like we have a bank of plants. And we have that bank, and that could be cells, it could be hairs, it could be like really non-invasively harvested cells. We just keep them. And then just like with the black-footed ferret, if they're needed, you could help a population regain that diversity. Florida panther is also a great example. It didn't involve cloning. The Florida panther was going to extinction, but just the introduction of two Texas pumas, which is originally the same, essentially the same species, help them survive and regain the diversity that they needed. And I should also say this doesn't have to be just cloning. It can involve all kinds of other things that involve, for example, the transfer of a germ cell, from one organism into another. You can have a chicken, for example, carry germ cells from a quail and produce quail. And so, the important thing is to have that samples, they are stored to have them for the future so that when you need them, when needed, they can help the population. And we know that the ecosystem is interlinked. So having the loss of one single species can affect the entire ecosystem. So what we want is just to use all the tools that we have available. And now we have molecular tools and we want to help conservation through them.
We're talking with UW-Madison geneticist Francisco Pellegri, who explores biobanking, cloning approaches, preserving endangered animal populations. How do you feel about attempts to clone already extinct animals? Could scientists be opening a Pandora's box, so to speak? Are there animals that we should prioritize over others? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute here on the Ideas Network. About 1 million species are on the verge of extinction. We're looking at what preventative steps are on the table as animals bear the brunt of habitat destruction, as the wildfires we've been talking about, unchecked hunting, fishing, human-caused climate change, of course, in there. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Maybe you've heard over the years about the modern-day Noah's Ark concept tissues from endangered animals being held in a bank in order to perhaps save species from extinction. How do you feel about this? 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison geneticist Francisco Pellegri, who's with us for the hour. Let's bring in Michelle in Wanakee with your thoughts. Michelle, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to come on and echo all of the sentiments I've been hearing and just stress the importance of DNA banking and keeping the genetic diversity of our world alive. And there's just so many things that are under threat right now because of global warming and just changes that are occurring, that I hope that this becomes more and more popular, because we're going to be losing more and more species. My particular interest is in coral reef conservation, and we see a lot of aquarists in the hobby that try to maintain samples, even if it's just among hobbyists or just different
citizen scientists.
Species of coral. Right, citizens, exactly. And there's a huge population of citizen scientists, particularly in that area. So I hope that more and more universities and labs can do this.
Oh, Michelle, thank you. And so, Francisco, Michelle, very supportive, wants to make sure that banking becomes more commonplace, and mentioned also coral reef banking. Go ahead, Francisco.
Yeah, thank you for the comments and your insights. And I agree that the concept of citizen scientists and conservationists is really important, that we all collaborate in our own ways. In fact, I have myself a small herd of Dartmoor ponies at home, which are a conservation genetics project also, in addition to the various species that we have in the lab to test some of the principles. So, you know, in my own way as a citizen, I'm also using that I believe in that principle. And I think we can all make a difference, and there's lots of us, and try to make a difference, we can really make that difference in the world.
Yeah. I've seen pictures of you with your ponies. Tell us more about what you're doing there in preserving.
Well, this was a kind of like a home experiment, personal experiment, to try to have a small farm off Madison. And what was interesting, using the land for some kind of conservation project. And at first I was thinking about all kinds of animals, you name it, wild mountain goats, river otters, or anything like that. And then at some point I also was looking at horses, just to have maybe one at home. And I realized that ponies are primitive horses, their actual ancestors became extinct, at least in the on the west side of the Ural Mountains. Fortunately, the wild the Przelski in the east side was able to recover from extinction. But these primitive breeds, they're as close as we have to the ancestor of horses. And so this one in particular was their grounds. They lived semi wild, and there were tens of thousands, and their grounds were next to an army base in World War II in England, and they were decimated to less than 12. Mm. And now they're back to 3,000, and so there's an effort to conserve these breeds. And these are what's called native breeds, which are essentially the most primitive breeds that you have. The equivalent, in say, in the dog world would be a dingo, or a Basenji, or something like that, or a Samoyed, and they're called natural breeds. They're a part of one way that we can contribute to keep genetic diversity, and also really the ancient populations of the animal world.
Have you taken any of their genetic material to bank? out of curiosity?
That's a great question, but I haven't done that yet, although I've thought about it. So I think that, you know, that we should have banks of...
You're falling down on the job, Francisco.
We definitely should have banks of breeds. And that's also something that has been proposed for agricultural stocks, because a lot of the agricultural stocks are becoming very homogeneous. And that's not good for the long term. And they're becoming homogeneous because there's a pressure to standardize a certain efficiency, but then a lot of the diversity is lost. And so that has been proposed also for agriculture. And I'm sure it will happen. And I suspect it will also happen for breeds. Yeah.
So when you take the hair and the blood and the muscle samples, but also the sperm and the embryos, what is the potential for successful artificial insemination or in vitro fertilization? How successful is that in animals?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think the old concept of biobanking was biobanking gametes, meaning sperm and eggs.
Mm-hmm.
That's, as you can imagine, that's highly invasive. And that's the last thing you want to do, especially for a species that might be endangered in the wild, right? But right now we have very different methods. We have, in 2005, we got the Nobel Prize for the scientists who discovered factors that could reprogram cells and make them what's called pluripotent. These are what's called induced pluripotent cells. So you can take any cell in a tissue and essentially turn it into a cell that can become other cells, including germ cells. So, for example, you could, and so we don't want to biobank. I don't think we should be biobanking gametes anymore. I think it might be under some circumstances useful, but right now we can just biobank hair samples. If you have if somebody else is doing a study that has blood that already is collecting blood for another reason, for example, in Australia they were collecting blood to understand the effects of climate change in turtles, and they had 300 blood samples. That's a great way to get a biobank out of a different study. Hmm. But you could also get cells out of fecal samples, because there's these intestinal cells and fecal samples. So there's a lot of non-invasive ways to collect samples. And so you could imagine, let's say we work on fish, we could go to a lake and try to get a fish and get a very small punch of the tip of a tail of a fish, and that would be a biopsy, and the fish within 10 days it will just completely heal that tail.
Huh.
But those tissues can be frozen, and then they can be turned into anything, including a gamete. And then that gamete could be, for example, put into a host that, say, we have in the lab, and we could recreate the fish that came from the wild, including its genetic diversity.
We're talking with Francisco Pellegri, who's a professor of genetics at UW-Madison, as we explore these biobanks, the storing of genetic material of at-risk animals, having biological tissues to perhaps one day revive extinct creatures. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Stephanie now in Milwaukee. Stephanie, hi.
Hi, I had a question for the speaker. I was wondering about how bees might be relevant in this conversation. I'm aware that they are critically more like endangered, and I think that they're very important for the environment. So I'm wondering if that would be something that's worthwhile looking into, or if there's already efforts going into looking into that.
Stephanie, thank you. Banking pollinators, Francisco.
Oh, bees. Sorry. Yeah, I missed that part. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we have three different. So what we specialize in our specific line of work is the idea that perhaps within a very related species, you could, in a sense, use the programs of development to help reproduction. So, for example, a simple example would be that the northern rhino embryos could survive in a southern rhino mother. So a northern rhino is essentially extinct, but you can get an embryo, and has been done, that has been born through a foster mother that was a related species. And so we basically use, we think about lineages of closely related species. And one of them is fish, because we have a lot of information and a lot of basic biology behind it. Another one is frogs, because there's also quite a bit of biology and a clearly endangered set of lineages. And another one is bees, because they're so important. And so right now, for example, we're thinking about applying the same concepts to bees and bumblebees, which are essential for pollination. And the nice thing about that is that everybody agrees that no matter how you see it, that bees are essential for society in their contribution to agriculture, for example, or in addition to its conservation aspect for the ecosystem.
Well, what about woolly mammoths? A group of scientists are working on the possibility of cloning woolly mammoths, which went extinct thousands of years ago. Is this a good use of the technology?
Yeah, I personally think that that project is detracting from the value of the method, because we know, so many of us, including Mary at the beginning, knows that there's so much to do now. There's so many species that are living right now that are not properly cared for. And so what we're trying to do in our own efforts is to focus on living species. And we're not trying to de-extinct anybody. There's this concept called the extinction vortex, which is essentially that once a species gets caught into a bad negative cycle in which you have few individuals, it becomes the genetic diversity goes down, it becomes inbred, and it's more susceptible to diseases, and then it becomes even less number, and it eventually becomes extinct. And so what we're trying to do is help provide techniques that will help re-inject biodiversity in a living species so they can maneuver its way away from those extinction vortex. Whether the woolly mammoth can be cloned or not, I think at some point there's a technical,
we'll have to, pause right there, and we'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. In announcing plans to remove nearly two dozen species from the endangered species list, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service stated almost 3 billion birds have been lost in North America since 1970. The agency went on to say these extinctions highlight the need to take action to prevent further losses. We're exploring what's possible through interspecies cloning, through biobanking the genetic material recovered from species near extinction or even already gone. What are your questions about this? 800-642-1234. We have Francisco Pellegri, who is a professor of genetics at UW-Madison. And Paul Robbins is here, dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, a mission to address rapid global environmental change. Paul, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've spent your career working on conservation. Why should people spend resources, scientists, focus on banking DNA when they could use them to save critical habitats, for instance, that animals need to survive?
So the answer, I guess, to that is yes. I have spent decades trying to conserve land and restore it, the habitat that's going to be essential for any species in the next century. The problem is time. We're running against the clock. As you mentioned, like one third of bird life in North America has vanished, even in my lifetime. I'm going to be leaving the planet to my son. It seems to me that biobanking is a good security against the rapidity, the speed of change, so that we'll have something to look back and restore to begin with. So I would say you do both. You have to restore ecosystems. You have to protect native habitat. And then you've got to make sure you've got something to return to the land.
But extinctions, they are a natural process that come about as environments change. We know our environment is changing due to us humans. Why should we interrupt this natural process of animal extinction?
Because we caused it. So it seems to me that you bet. There's no evolution without extinction. Extinction is natural. So is reproduction, which is essentially what these genetic tools are really all about. So given that we've already intervened in the Earth system to such a scale, we being certain human beings, not everybody on the planet has a heavy footprint. Certainly I have had an influence on the land, the way I use energy, the way I use land. That makes me responsible. You know, if you break it, you kind of own it. And it seems to me that there's nothing more unnatural than what we've done to all the non-humans on the planet. As Stuart Brand famously says, if we're going to be as gods, we might as well get good at it. So using these tools is a way to remediate some of what we've done.
Francisco, you know, I vividly recall when Dolly the sheep was born in 1996. I vividly recall seeing Dolly the sheep on the cover of Time magazine, and it was such a big to-do on the first successful clone. How far have scientists come since Dolly?
Well, they've been able to clone in a way that is much safer. That is, that right now, clones, for example, are known to, from various studies, to be as healthy as naturally reproduced animals. There's lots of studies in various systems, and they have also been able to clone now endangered species, either through populations that are through eggs that are not the same population or through populations that are the same species but are domesticated, like in the ferret. And so we've gone really a long way. I think we've also gone a long way in another way, in other aspects, which is reprogramming. And that allows us to take any sample, as I was mentioning before, and turn it into a gamete, for example. It could be a drop of blood. You can clone an animal from a droplet of blood. You can clone an animal from a hair follicle cell. So, you know, all those are huge advances that can not only clone, but make germ cells and put them into an animal that will be a host. And then, yes, you will have a chimeric animal in one generation, but the next generation, you're back on track. You're back to the actual pure species. And so all that has come from advances through the methods that we have, as well as our understanding of basic developmental genetics, which allows us to now think in these different ways.
With these biobanks, Paul, it really stands out to me that scientists straight across the world, they have to cooperate. I mean, you can't do this alone. One university can't take this all on. One San Diego Zoo can't do this all. Where do you see cooperation in this effort to store these materials and really make sure that this is being done in a sustainable, you know, ethical way?
That's a great question. We've been thinking a lot about this here on the Madison campus, where some genetic banking has been going on for quite some time. It's going on quietly all over the world in different places, using different methods, different protocols, and, you know, different approaches, which may be more politically or culturally appropriate under the circumstances. So the idea that there'll be some master plan coming from the IUCN or other greater conservation body to tell everybody how to do this is probably grossly unrealistic. I think we've settled on the idea that this is going to be a multi-centered effort. So a university here, the San Diego Zoo there, people in Costa Rica there. And what we need to do at that point is make sure that our protocols and our metadata, like tracking, in other words, the provenance of where these samples come from, is really, really rigorous. So everybody's doing it the right way. But that doesn't mean we tell everybody how or under what conditions to do it. So it seems to me that the biggest problem is precisely coordination. Even on our own campus, when Francisco and I kind of looked under the hood, what we found is dozens of labs doing something like this. And we're not even talking to one another yet. So yes, coordination, cooperation, but that's exciting. That's enormously exciting.
Francisco, how do you feel about that collaborative effort around the world? And then, you know, tracking samples in a way that, you know, is similar to the standards that you want straight across the board so that they are scientifically, you know, the efficacy is there.
Oh, sure. Well, I think it's the right way to think about it, that it's going to be a decentralized network, and it's almost a necessity, because a lot of the countries may just want to keep the samples in their own land, and indeed that is the case for many countries. And so I think what we need is a database that can be shared and then understand what those standards would be. And really, it's not that hard to keep samples a certain way that is just preserved. And then there might be more advanced ways to sample, to collect those samples. For example, you could make pools of induced pluripotent cells and then store everything extremely efficiently, so that it takes very little space. And you could work with others and share those protocols and eventually reach those efforts. And then when the efforts are needed, then that also promotes communication and collaboration.
And surely people have thought about backing up these banks. Like, so if one bank has a catastrophic, something happens that it's preserved elsewhere.
Exactly. And in fact, we need duplicates of everything. I was just speaking to a scientist here on campus who was saying that there was at one point a bank of samples of chimpanzees from Rwanda. And he had one bank here in Wisconsin, and the other one in Rwanda got lost through a catastrophic a mudslide. Mm. And so having those duplicates is going to be essential. But we can do that because we have ways to, for example, grow cells that represent those individual species. I think the hardest thing is going to be to actually get the samples in a way that is effective, that is non-invasive, and that we can sample before the diversity is lost.
We have Francisco Pellegri, who is a genetics professor at the UW. Paul Robbins is here, dean of the UW-Madison's Nelson Institute, as we look at how banking genetic material could be used in support of species conservation. With your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Paul, what about unintended consequences of technology and the ethics around this? There are the ethical concern of whether scientists should be tinkering with life and what happens if something goes wrong. How do you address those concerns?
I get this question. This question comes up a lot. I think it's a fair question. We all remember the cane toad set loose on the Australian outback to terrible effect. Reintroduction of species, though, is a 100-year-old business. We've had a lot of experience with what can go wrong and a lot of experience with what can go right. A recent study by Ben Novak at Revive and Restore on the West Coast studied hundreds and hundreds of North American reintroductions. These are just reintroductions of species that either been long gone or didn't live in these places. And he found one out of about 1,000 went wrong. So the first argument I would make is we're pretty good at this. We're a lot better than we were, you know, in the 1940s. The second piece is, okay, unintended consequences are possible. We release a black-footed ferret. Something could go wrong, I suppose. But what are the intended consequences? The intended consequences are to restore a species that would otherwise vanish. And we have to weigh the benefits against the costs and ask ourselves, what's the cost of sitting on our hands and not doing this? In 50 or 75 years, when those species are gone, and people say they could have done it, why didn't they? I think we need to be able to balance the risk of unintended consequences over intended consequences.
Francisco, you spoke briefly about the woolly mammoth. What do you see as ethical concerns as we should prioritize and consider what we do about cloning animals?
They're existing right now, and that's for reasons that they're here. They're not. Everybody agrees that they belong. They have an ecosystem so that they have a place to be. And then from a technical perspective, going back in time just makes it really much more difficult to recreate what the original species was. You can't, even if you had the full sequence of DNA, you cannot make an animal out of a DNA that is in a microchip, that is just that you just sequence and you have the sequence. You have to have a physical sample. Maybe hundreds of years from now, we can actually create an animal from a sequence itself that is, in a computer. But right now, there's no way in sight in the horizon that we can do that in the next couple of 100 years from what I see. So we really want to make sure that we don't just generate more kind of complexity in that new species that are being created just because we can. What we really are trying to do is conserve the species that are here naturally, just by providing them tools that are new tools that are going to be part of our arsenal.
So how would you then prioritize, what species come first and where our priorities should be in this?
Yeah, we've talked quite a bit about this. Paul, do you want to take this one or?
Well, yeah, I think there's two perspectives on this. Pick the species that you're really worried about, the taxa, sets of species, and then really work aggressively to try to make sure you've got a very highly diverse bank of those species. I think our perspective has shifted, or mine has, towards something that's much more opportunistic. Across the state of Wisconsin, wonderful people who work at the DNR, who work for not-for-profits, who work at the universities, are already coming into contact with a huge range of wildlife. They're in their labs. They're doing necroscopies of wolves. If we just biobanked everything we touched in a very rigorous way, we'd have a huge bank in no time. So rather than try to pick winners and losers, which I think is a fraught enterprise, why not just bank everything we get our hands on? It's cheap, it's across the board, and we'll thank ourselves later. So I guess I'm gonna punt on that one and just say, we need to do the most practical things now.
We're exploring biobanking genetic material. And with your thoughts as well, Nelson Institute Dean Paul Robbins there, UW-Madison geneticist Francisco Pellegri there here as well. Still time to talk about what you think will it take to stop a global mass extinction. Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about cells from critically endangered animals being stored in biobanks, potentially advancing wildlife conservation worldwide. A study in the journal Science Advances summed up our challenge. Human impact can explain 96% of all mammal species extinctions of the last 126,000 years. Still time to talk about biobanks and about interspecies cloning. 800-642-1234. We have UW conservationist Paul Robbins with us and geneticist Francisco Pellegri, who stay with us for about 9 more minutes. We heard from Matt in Wausau. Francisco emailed us to ask about where these animals will live once we use DNA to clone and revive them. Will they be relegated to zoos, Matt asks, since we've destroyed so much of their natural habitats?
Yeah, that's a great question. The idea is not to wait until the habitat has been destroyed. The idea is just to have the banks rely on the existing habitats and then monitor genetic diversity. And if at some point it seems that the genetic diversity is becoming so low that the animal might go into that extinction vortex that I mentioned before, then you would act and maybe take one of the samples that you have, maybe perhaps 50 cells in a pool that you have frozen, and maybe you have 1,000. You can recreate that pool, and then as you thaw it out, and then you can put a copy back in the library, and then with the others that you have thawed out, you can maybe create 50 individuals that have new genetic diversity, and that just re-inject that in the existing ecosystem. So it's not about zoos, it's about the natural environment and just preserving it.
Yeah, I just imagine scientists checking out DNA from the library. Paul, is that far-fetched?
Oh, I think we might be a little ahead of ourselves there. I think the big question, I want to answer the first question, which is, should we be restoring habitat? And the answer is yes. You know, this goes alongside. Whose data is going to be, I think, a very interesting problem. So as Francisco suggested, there are some countries who are quite hesitant to export the genetic materials that they are banking or protecting. And I understand that. And I think we should be much more consultative from the outset about data sovereignty, as our native nations in the state call it. These are brother and sister animals for many people who live in this state. And maybe they don't want that DNA just checked out by anyone. I think those kinds of protocols really need to be discussed politically and culturally before we start thinking about this as a free good.
Yeah. Francisco, what are your thoughts there on data sovereignty and how we handle genetic materials?
Yeah, absolutely. The data bases should be in a place that is according to sovereignty of the local people, and they should be used according to the wishes of the people. And all that we're trying to do is set up proof of principle systems that can be used for others if they want to.
You know, practically speaking, Francisco, what is needed to get a genetic bank established and off the ground? I mean, I saw one picture where it looked like, I don't know, there was steam coming out of somewhere in San Diego's. Like, what do you need to preserve these materials?
Yeah, that steam is probably liquid nitrogen.
Yeah.
So the traditional way is you get samples and then you freeze them in liquid nitrogen. And, you know, there's one of the reasons I mentioned pooled samples is so that you could have, rather than having 50 individual tubes, for example, you could just have one. And so that would save a lot of space because, of course, there is some cost to having the container and also even a carbon footprint. We're also talking about trying to get plants, animal cells be more like seeds. So, for example, there's what's called bio-inspired products, gene products that can make an animal cell be more resilient. Think about tardigrades. Tardigrades are these water bears. They can survive desiccation. They can survive being in space. That's because they produce certain gene products that make cells essentially resistant. And so you could imagine a time where we can take cells, we can treat them with some RNAs, the same way that, for example, you got an RNA vaccine against COVID right now. You can treat them. And then you can just store them at maybe 15 degrees below zero, just like the plant vault. Mm-hmm. And so that would be a very sustainable way of having a bank. And also we're trying to develop those efficient and smart ways of storing samples.
You mentioned plant vault, and Becky from Hustisford called and asked about the plants these animals need to survive. What about the food animals eat? Are those plants also being preserved and banked?
Yes, they are. In fact, the plant vault is a great example in Norway, but there's many of these plant vaults all over the world, and we're just not so aware of them, and they're not controversial. Everybody agrees that we should have plant vaults, that's a good idea, and I think a lot of times when we present the idea of an animal vault compared to a plant vault, it actually starts making more sense to other people. A lot of the animals, of course, there's in an ecosystem, there's interactions that are obligatory. So, for example, in Wisconsin, there's a butterfly called the Kärntner blue butterfly, which requires, it has an obligatory plant, which is the wild looping. And so if you want to make sure that you store, you want to preserve the butterfly, the Kärntner blue butterfly, you also have to think about the plant. So everything's going to have to be integrated. And so we're trying to just get the animal world to catch up in this concept of storing samples for the future.
Hmm. Paul, as you look at this integration across ecosystems in the world, do you envision Wisconsin or perhaps UW-Madison having its own genetic bank? Because you talked about labs and scientists doing banking here and there all over the place.
Yeah, I think that that's the next step. I think it would not be very difficult. And here I really do defer to Francisco on what it would take. But the more I talk to him, the more it seems to me that this is doable now. And now would be the time, given the rapidity of species loss. I think if it's really a coordination question, if scientists and the DNR and citizens are interested in this process, there's no reason we couldn't come up with some kits for people to work with, some protocols that make sure that we know where the data come from and where they're going, and then, you know, a lot of liquid nitrogen. And if we can put those things together, I think we could biobank Wisconsin right now.
What about the cost, Francisco? Is genetic banking costly? Can this happen on a large scale?
I think the cost will come mostly with sample acquisition, and a lot of the samples could be acquired in a way that is just part of ongoing efforts that are already part of field studies, for example. I mentioned the study in Australia, but there's lots of studies in Wisconsin, but I'll just mention the one in Australia where there were already 300 samples of blood from turtles. And that was part of the study on the effect of climate change on the on whether a turtle turned into a male or a female. So if you, and there's lots of studies like that in Wisconsin, of course. There's a strong conservation studies here, and we could also partner with those studies and just make part of the process of field study, have as part of the protocol, get a small sample which can be brought back to the lab and frozen. And those costs, the liquid nitrogen costs, are not expensive. And there's going to be more and more ways to make things more efficient as time goes on.
Francisco and Paul, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Paul Robbins, Dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. Francisco Pellegri is Professor of Genetics and Medical Genetics at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.